What's up, everyone? I'm here again to talk to you guys about our sponsor, ButcherBox. I've talked about it before that I used to use these guys even before they were on the podcast. You get 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Everything's humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. Plus, it makes life a lot easier. You don't have to go to the grocery store. You're not paying a ton of money. You're getting really great deals, and it's all shipped to you free, easy, convenient. My freezer is always stocked with meat. You know, you just take something out, defrost it, throw it in the oven, make it work. It's easy. They've got also curated tips and recipes based on your box. And like I said, the money is really good, far better than going and getting crummy meat at your local grocery store or going to a fancy butcher or Whole Foods or something like that. Today, ButcherBox is giving our listeners free ground beef for life of your membership, plus an additional $20 off your first order. Use my link, butcherbox.com/underworld, and use code underworld to get free ground beef for life, plus $20 off your first box. That's butcherbox.com/underworld and code underworld.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
What's up, everyone? This is Danny Gold. I host the Underworld podcast along with my partner, Sean Williams. Just wanted to update our regular listeners because we didn't have a normal episode this week. We will be back next week with a really good episode that I'm very excited about. But for this week, we at least wanted to give you guys a taste of what you can get on the Patreon, patreon.com/theunderworldpodcast. So we put up a lot of interviews there with journalists, people involved in criminal lifestyles, law enforcement, things like that. This week, Sean spoke to Max Daly, who's based in London. He's the global drugs editor for Vice, and he wrote a book in 2013 called Narcomania, which is about Britain's drug scene. Sean talks to him about London's drug and knife crime explosion, Albanian takeovers, and fun things like that. So if you guys want more of that, patreon.com/theunderworldpodcast. $5 a month gets you tons of bonus episodes. For 10 or 15, we'll give you the scripts and all our sources and things like that. And yeah, hope you enjoy it. Next week, we will be back with a great one.
Hello, welcome all to a bonus episode of the Underworld podcast. I'm your host, Sean Williams, and I'm joined today, rarely, by a fellow Londoner, Max Daly, who's an award-winning investigative journalist working the drugs and crime beat for Vice. Max's book, Narcomania, How Britain Got Hooked on Drugs, came out 8 years ago. And since then, he's been tracking how the UK's drug industry is becoming one of the world's biggest. And we're going to cover a whole bunch of fascinating things on this show, including county lines, so-called woke coke, Albanians. Yes, Albanians. I know you guys love that. And something called cuckooing, which sounds a bit like cottaging, but I'm pretty sure it's different. So first of all, welcome to the show, Max Daly.
Hi, Sean. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So I think we were first chatting about doing an interview back in the early throes of the lockdown, and you were writing about a lot about how the pandemic was affecting drug use in the UK. There was a story about drug dealers dressing up as NHS nurses, which is pretty crazy. What did COVID actually do to the industry? Did it change it a great deal?
I think when we were sort of monitoring this and, you know, seeing how, because you would have thought, you know, because the drug trade is relies a lot of people traveling about on the streets, hanging around on the streets, doing kind of delivery, you know, running around, giving each other bits and bobs, then you think, you know, this has got to be massively hit by the by the severe lockdowns. And I think it was definitely affected like everything else. But what we found out, as per usual with the drug trade, is that because people desperately want drugs and people desperately want to make money out of selling drugs, there will always be a way of of putting those two together. And that's what happened. So you had drug dealers disguising themselves quite cleverly as delivery riders and nurses and people who sort of had legitimate reasons for being in the street, also taxi drivers. So they were sort of just kind of working a little bit more sort of undercover, being a little bit more clever. And also, you know, there was a lot of areas, you know, particularly around suburbia and slightly quieter towns and villages where you could still kind of meet people in parks and at the back of buildings and in alleys, and no one would really notice if you were kind of swift enough. So basically, and I spoke to a lot of long-term heroin users and crack users, as well as the dealers, and even some heroin and crack users tried. Some of them tried to use the lockdown as a chance to sort of give up, because they thought, "Well, look, I'm finding it a bit of a hassle. It's not as easy as it was to get drugs. I might use this opportunity to try and get off drugs." But when sort of normal service resumed sort of pretty quickly, they found that they could get drugs as easy as before. A lot of them just immediately fell off the wagon and got back into it again. And in terms of what we saw sort of globally, again, you know, obviously it did impact things almost immediately in terms of, you know, the shipping from China and the Mexican cartels getting hold of their synthetic drugs to make fentanyl and things like that. So there was an initial sort of problems that including the, you know, the Italian mafia getting the cocaine into Europe. They had to get around these problems, but, you know, like on the smaller scale of the little crack and heroin dealers in London, you know, the big suppliers and traffickers all had workarounds. You know, they just used slightly different routes, and obviously, you know, they could still smuggle drugs in huge amounts of freight, because obviously freight was still going on after it initially was sort of curtailed a little bit. But, you know, the freight trade was still happening. You know, that's why we could all still eat food and all the stuff. So drugs was just being even more cleverly hidden amongst, you know, the global exchange of goods.
Yeah, and there's been a few trends that you've been tracking over the last couple of years or so. It seems that they're more like international gangs, different kind of so-called ethnic gangs working in London these days or in the UK.
Yeah, so obviously in the olden days, you know, when the drug trade in the UK started becoming a thing, a powerful thing, you know, I suppose from the 70s and 80s and 90s, that's where the sort of the big crime guys in the UK started switching from armed robbery, basically, and all types of robbery and thievery, and that's where they started switching to the drug trade. You know, we saw that what's going on in the Godfather books, you know, with the you know, the mafia clans going, oh yeah, let's maybe get into drugs because it's going to be the next big thing. And obviously drugs was the next big thing, and the UK gangs got involved with cocaine and cannabis. A lot of the armed robbers who had fled to Spain because Spain didn't have an extradition treaty with the UK. When they fled there in the 80s and 90s, they suddenly realised that more and more cocaine was coming into the Spanish ports from the cartels in South America. And they thought, right, we'll have a piece of this action. And, you know, as was, you know, hash coming into Spain from all parts as well. So they thought, let's have a piece of this action. We'll get involved in drugs. Let's forget armed robbery, because armed robbery was also getting too tough as well. There's too much security. Banks were getting too wise into this. So a lot of the big gangs got involved in drugs, and hence you got you know, the widespread and the price drop of cocaine because the supply was improved into this country. And then what happens is because of globalization and immigration, you start having other groups sort of muscling in on the action in terms of, you know, muscling out the traditional white crime gangs, especially in, you know, more multicultural cities like London and Bristol and Nottingham. You had a lot of the Jamaican gangs getting involved in crack and weed selling. And then later on, you had the Vietnamese gangs getting involved in cannabis production, and then the Albanian crews getting involved in the cocaine trade, largely on the back of their already existing people trafficking trade. So the Albanians were quickly, just because they had started, like many other countries, like many other criminal gangs around Europe, you know, across Eastern Europe, they had increased connections with the cartels in South America. So the Albanians could go straight there and get the cocaine. And obviously one of the best markets in the world for selling cocaine is Europe. And one of the best markets in Europe is the UK. It's a very lucrative market. A lot of people take a lot of coke. It's a lot of money to be had. And the Albanians, they weren't... You know, a lot of people have said that they sort of took over the trade because they were like super crazy violent, which isn't the truth at all. They're no more violent than anyone else. They just got organized, use existing trafficking routes that they had used to sort of dominate Soho's sex trade, you know, in the 90s. And they also just did a bit of undercutting as well. You know, their labor was cheap, and they, you know, like any new gang in the neighborhood, they'll undercut the opposition to getting in first, and they, you know, that they've been fairly sort of popular in the underworld as operators, you know, reliable, good to work with. And now, not only are the Albanians successful in terms of the cocaine trade, but they've also shouldered aside the Vietnamese and are running the UK's cannabis farm trade as well in the main. Obviously, you also get a lot of white you know, domestic gangs involved in that still, and also just, you know, one-off people who just want to grow weed. But in terms of the organized kind of element of cannabis farms, the Albanians are quite heavily involved. They traffic poor Albanians and young Albanians over to the UK to work as sort of cannabis farm slaves, a bit like happened with the Vietnamese sort of 10 years ago.
And you reported relatively recently that there's been a sort of uptick in the number of violent attempts to take over cannabis farms in the country, and people are getting killed in that as well. So what's going on there?
Yeah, it's because I sort of keep an eye on Britain's drug world. I did start spotting, you know, and I look at a lot of the local newspaper headlines as well, and get a fair bit of information coming into my brain. I started sort of noticing that there was just a lot of violence associated with cannabis farms, because you wouldn't sort of usually kind of think about cannabis farms being particularly violent. You know, it's just people growing cannabis plants and then getting rid of it and selling it and then growing more. And they just don't want any hassle. They just want to do their thing and go. But what I'd found out actually from interviewing this guy a couple of years ago in I think it was Kent, he was actually a professional cannabis farm raider. So it was his role, his speciality. And you have a lot of specialities in the criminal world. People get commissioned to do what they're good at doing. And what he was good at doing was raiding cannabis farms. So that, you know, one of his mates or someone in the gang would get wind that there was a cannabis farm operating in XX Street. So they, what they'd do, they'd plan a raid on it. They'd maybe scout it out for a day or so, work out how many people were operating from there and whether they might be armed and how dangerous they looked. And if they thought they had a good chance, they would, you know, raid it, usually at night. They'll break in, they'll burgle it, probably armed with knives or baseball bats. Sometimes kind of kick the shit out of the people who are working there or running it. Sometimes they just leave them alone or tie them up and just nick their whole, you know, cannabis farm. Just grab the, you know, stick it all in bin liners and shove it in the car and drive off. And, you know, and obviously that's, you know, worth up to sort of 30 grand or whatever. Or, you know, at least per crop. So it's, you know, it's better than stealing an iPhone. And so because I've been speaking to this guy who made a living of it, you know, I think he burgled up to sort of 30 or 40, 50 cannabis farms himself during his career. Then I did also start spotting that the violence started increasing, and there was one particular case which I feature in that article. About a, I think he was a young, like, jiu-jitsu champion for Britain, a young Asian guy. And, you know, lots of pictures of him on the internet of winning at his sport. And what him and a group of friends decided they were going to burgle a cannabis farm. North, I can't quite remember where it was. I think it's somewhere in the Midlands, actually. And unfortunately for them, the people who own the cannabis farm happened to also live in the house next door, and they were a group, a bunch of Asian guys as well. And they were armed with a crossbow, so they shot a crossbow and it killed the one of the young kids. But he also, the guy who shot a crossbow, happened to also accidentally kill his brother, I think. So he was done for double murder. And that's just one example of a lot of these quite nasty, you know, some of them deliberate murders of people who are just kind of being paid probably quite low amounts of money to look after these flipping plants. And usually they're sort of have to sleep in the same room. There's nothing they can do. They have like pot noodles. It's quite a grim life. And then someone breaks in and stabs them. That's the sort of the nasty side of the cannabis trade. And obviously it's a great argument for legalizing cannabis, because none of this stuff would happen if cannabis was legalized.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, another part of the news that, I mean, I've been away from the UK for ages, so I'm probably well out of touch, but we're fed a load of stories about County Lyons, specifically how drug gangs are, you know, using young kids, teenagers to run drugs all over the country. Is that, are they getting younger? Like, how is County Lyons developing? I guess we should also describe for listeners what County Lyons even is.
Yeah, so County Lyons is a sort of a drug dealing business model where you're sending out sort of inner city drug gangs are sending out young kids, usually teenagers, you know, sometimes as young as 12, 13, to go out to, it used to be called going country or going out there, OT. They would send them out to satellite towns and ports and stuff to just expand the drug trade out of the city. And they used these young kids because it was cheap labor, because they were, no one really sort of bothered them because they were so young. The local police forces had no idea that these young kids buzzing around town were anything to do with class A, you know, crack and heroin drug trade, because obviously County Lyons is all about crack and heroin. It's not really much to do with cannabis or powder cocaine. So they'd go out, these young kids, usually with a manager, would go out and start selling to local. They'd take over the local heroin and crack trade. And what they found out, you know, over time was that they couldn't just wander around in the streets because the police kind of cottoned onto the fact that there was a lot of black kids from London wandering around Ipswich or wherever. So those kids were just picked up at the train station. So what happened next is that they had to find a sort of a drug den to sell from. So they were off street. And what they did was that they took over dependent heroin users' council flats. They would pay them, you know, a kind of a rock every couple of hours. And they can just sit in their house 24/7 and use that as a dealing hub, and so therefore be harder to catch. And this model, which I trace back to about 1999 in Brighton, when a lot of young Brixton kids were selling crack and heroin in Brighton. Mm-hmm. So since 1999, that sort of method has expanded pretty much around the country with the use of these young kids, some of whom are coerced into it, some of whom are sort of really up for it. Obviously, if you're a kid, you know, you're going to be up for doing a lot of things that you probably shouldn't be doing and that are probably very dangerous. And you know, and a lot of these kids have really come across. You know, they are stuck in between a rock and a hard place. They've got the police on one side, they've got rival gangs and even their bosses on the other side. So ultimately they're not really earning more money than McDonald's, but they're not earning any great riches. And in the end, they'll usually either come home with their tail between their legs after having a huge beating to their mum and dad, or they'll end up in prison, they'll end up injured. So it's sort of, it's not ideal way of spending your youth, you know, when you should be doing biology GCSE, you know, instead you're sitting in a sort of a heroin user's real shithole flat selling crack and heroin 24/7 with very little break. You know, all you're eating is McDonald's and playing games on your phone. I mean, it's not a very glamorous life, despite what Snapchat and stuff might say.
Yeah, and you've been working on some stuff about that, right? Can you get into that? I think when this will be going out, the big story that we were talking about before we went on air, that will just be coming out at Vice. Can you tell me a little bit more about the kind of reporting that you were doing for that?
What if I told you that there was someone out there who kept a log of every single thing you did every minute of the day? I think that's a pretty creepy thing. But what if I told you that's exactly what's happening every time you go online? Your internet provider, like AT&T or Verizon, they're allowed to store logs of every website you've ever visited. Every website. And can legally sell this data to anyone. That's why I always use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers so your internet provider can't see or log what you do online. And unlike a lot of other VPNs, they don't store any of that data. They use something called trusted server technology. They were the first major VPN provider to engineer all of their VPN servers to run on RAM only, which makes it impossible for them to store any data, including logs, of any ExpressVPN customer. So for me, when I'm doing research for an episode, you know, we're looking into really shady stuff, it's kind of better that that we're not storing that data, that no one can see that. And I know for Sean in his personal life, he's you know, he's visiting certain streaming websites and other websites that, you know, he wouldn't like other people to know that he goes on. So both of us, we use ExpressVPN to keep what we want to keep private and secure. Stop letting people keep logs of what you do online. Visit expressvpn.com/underworld right now and find out how you can get 3 months free. That's expressvpn.com/underworld, expressvpn.com/underworld to learn more.
Yeah, so since 2017, really, there has been a steady rise. Apart from last year, which was lockdown, there's been a jump in the number of young people killing each other. I mean, and the figures were fairly high. You know, I think the last high was 2008, 2009, when it was in the media a lot before, you know, then. But basically this year there's been 25 teenagers who have been killed in street stabbings and shootings in London so far this year, and that's sort of double what it was last year.
Wow, and that's huge.
And it has gone up, and I think the record was something like 28, 29 in 2008. So it looks like, because there was another 3 months to go this year, it doesn't look great in terms of being a record-breaking year for teenage killings. And the problem is that what I've been seeing in the last year in particular was they're getting younger and younger. So, you know, the year started off, I think it was January the 3rd, started off with the stabbing to death of a 13-year-old boy in Reading, which is in quite a well-off part of sort of suburb of
I went to uni in Reading, actually, so I know.
You know it well. I mean, and it was in this particular park. I can't remember what it's called, but it's quite a sort of a well-off part of Reading. You know, total suburbia, and it's this 13-year-old kid gets stabbed to death on January the 3rd, and it turns out, you know, the people who have been convicted of stabbing to death was a 13-year-old and two 13-year-olds and a 14-year-old. He was sort of lured. It was very much connected to Snapchat. You know, the young guy's obsession with knives, the beef that was developed, the planning of it, the honey trap element of it, where the girl persuaded Ollie to go to the park on false pretenses, and then he got ambushed by the two boys who stabbed him to death. And that was, you know, that was the start. That was 3 days into the year. Then, you know, since then, there has been a steady, I think it's, you know, one every 10 days, a teenager is killed in London. I mean, it hasn't actually kicked off as bad as everyone thought it would this summer. But there still has been a steady trickle of people dying across the country. At a very young age, and it's very young people doing it as well. It's not like it's sort of, you know, thugs in their 20s, like stabbing and bullying little kids. You know, the ones who are doing the stabbing and killing are the same age as them. And there was that case also recently where there was a dad went to kind of rescue his girl, 14-year-old daughter, who was being abused by some youths, and he got stabbed to death in Chingford, I think, North London. But and the kid who's been charged is 14. So it's just this sort of really, it's like, what the fuck is going on? You know, why, you know, in one of the richest countries in the world, why are children on a regular basis killing each other on the streets? You know, a lot of them are killing each other on the way home from school. Or, you know, this isn't all stuff that's happening in dark alleyways and, you know, whatever. This is stuff that's happening with kids in their school uniform outside McDonald's within full view of the public, and with flipping machetes. You know, we're not talking about Stanley knives. We're talking about absolute proper swords that people are getting attacked with. And it's very open. I mean, I saw it the other day in my street, some kids running after each other with machetes. And you know, you used to start seeing foxes all the time in London. I remember thinking, blimey, there's a fox. And now you see foxes everywhere. And then now it's like, literally, you're not surprised when you see someone walking around with a zombie knife. Or being chased, or a helicopter hovering overhead because there's another dead body in the street, two streets away. So what I thought, okay, well, what is going on here?
Yeah.
And I know that the authorities, you know, the Home Office, the Scotland Yard, all those sort of people have, since 2017, have tried to put the blame on the drug trade. And I sort of smelled a rat, and I thought, hold on, that sounds like total bullshit to me. So I kind of investigated that and looked into the cases. This is a few years ago. I did a piece and found out that but not very many of them were to do with drugs, turf wars. You know, it wasn't, Britain was not, you know, London was not the wire. And that most of the time, as it would be with kids, that these were like, you know, petty beefs and silly arguments and sort of pointless postcode rivalries, but which were not based on drug turf, but literally based on no reason whatsoever. So a lot of it was almost quite sort of nihilistic. You know, people were just killing each other because, you know, because they just didn't care. And because someone had slighted someone, you know, or in street terms, they'd violated them. So the only way that you can survive on the streets is by keeping your reputation above a certain level. And if it goes below a certain line, you have to do something to correct that. And you do that by stabbing someone and recording that sometimes on Snapchat so everybody knows what you've done. You've got your revenge. So very little to do with drug turf war and money and very much to do with this sort of weird situation now where it's a mixture of, you know, poverty, claustrophobic living, people developing these crazy little beefs over Snapchat and then using that platform as a way of sort of a scoreboard of keeping up with, you know, who's injured or stabbed who amongst rival groups. And then not only is it a sort of a enabler of it, then what you do is you boast about what you've done on Snapchat afterwards. And surprise, surprise, although the police aren't, you know, they haven't got enough resources to monitor Snapchat 24/7, but the police have, you know, used Snapchat evidence to nail people. And obviously, so it's obviously stupid. No other, you know, 20 years ago, you know, like gang people would never have gone anywhere near someone like Snapchat because they know that it would put them in the dock. But these days, because they're kids, they just do not give a shit. You know, they literally do not care. They, you know, the fact that they'll kill someone, they'll stick it on Snapchat and go, ha ha, I've killed someone.
Which gives even more credence to this kind of nihilist side of it as well.
Completely. I mean, obviously, some of them try and cover it up, and some of them are a bit cautious. But there's so much, so many kind of convictions that I've been told about that have involved evidence from Snapchat. That you know, they are kind of digging their own grave as well as killing other people. And it's just, I mean, ultimately, it's I've been told by youth workers that it's a lot to do with. You know, shame. A lot of them have been shamed all their lives. They've had very difficult lives, a lot involving kind of domestic violence, extreme poverty, really bad treatment at the hands of schools and police, at the hands of their own parents. And they've been shamed all their lives. And so, you know, if their sort of their tiny ego is dented at all or is challenged, they lash out because shame is a very powerful emotion. I mean, that's what, you know, youth workers have been telling me.
Well, why Snapchat as well? Are its like safety features just lower than other forms of media, or is there any particular reason why the kids use that?
Well, it's that Generation Z, isn't it? I mean, that's right. Their means of communication. I mean, you know, that you don't, you know, if you're a boy who's whatever 14 who's chatting up a girl, you don't ask her for a phone number. You ask her for a snap, you know. And that's how they communicate. But it just so happens that the everyday normal communication between people who are aged 13, 14, 15 is absolutely rife with horrific images of people getting stabbed to death. You know, I mean, that's just the way is for teenagers now, who that, you know, their main method of communication is also being used as a sort of a platform for violence.
Yeah, that's fucking awful.
I mean,
such
we have we've contacted Snapchat and are awaiting their reply on our accusations that it sort of the platform enables extreme youth violence and does nothing about it.
Mm. And it gives to segue into another sort of another area of reporting of yours that will segue itself into something else that's come into the media recently is that the government just always seems to be tone deaf on this stuff, and it doesn't seem to want to point the finger in the direction of anything that would do any good. I'm thinking in terms of woke coke in particular, and the accusation leveled that it's trying to sort of ignite a class war, I guess, in order to justify the increase in violence and drug crime in the country. What do you make about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a flipping disgrace. I mean, it's, you know, I am a bit of a rant factor 10 on this one, but it's a disgrace that, you know, the government knows that one of the main reasons for, you know, the rise in crime and youth violence, the rise in number of people addicted to drugs, it's totally connected to austerity. And, you know, the fact that the safety net has been pulled away from a lot of the most vulnerable populations in this country over the last 10 years. You know, David Cameron's Conservative government started doing that from 2009 onwards. And there's been many reports. There were many reports written in 2008, 2009, saying, if you carry on doing this, crime will go crazy. And they carried on doing this and crime's gone crazy. But so obviously the government doesn't want to say, oh shit, all this youth crime, these youth stabbings, this rise in drug dealing everywhere, the rising number of people who want to buy drugs to kind of escape their misery. They don't want to say this to do with austerity and thousands of youth clubs being closed and all that. They would rather say, hey, I've got a clever idea. Let's blame drug users. And they can't blame all drug users because they don't want to say, hey, it's the fault of Billy the Builder who likes a line after coming off the construction site or whatever in The Dog and Duck. It's a lot more of a sort of a culture war sort of hit that they know that a lot of the right-wing newspapers are going to love. If they can go for the middle class, you know, the fabled middle class dinner party coke snorters. And obviously when I say fabled, you know, it's fabled because, you know, you could have maybe said that in the 1990s, but I think in 2021, trying to say that cocaine is a drug of the middle classes and dinner parties and stuff is a bit silly.
I mean, anyone who goes down to Millwall or Charlton on a Saturday afternoon knows that it's not just a middle class pursuit.
Exactly. I mean, was that guy snorting cocaine on the day of the England Italy final outside Wembley, pictured in the sun? I think he was the same guy who had a flare stuck up his bum. But you know, was that guy a middle class dinner party? I don't think so. Not only has the government and the police as well used this as an opportunity, not only has it diverted people, the public, away from the real reasons why this shit is happening, it's sort of used it, it's twisted it to sort of blame drug users. And obviously it's in its interest to reduce demand because obviously the police and the government and the border police can't reduce supply. They find it very hard to reduce supply of cocaine and other drugs. So the only thing that they can try and do is sort of try and reduce the demand for it. And one of their methods of reducing their demand is to try and, you know, publicity sort of campaigns and PR to try and say, hey, people taking drugs is really, not only is it unhealthy, but it's actually, you're killing people. And they are right, you know. The drug trade is not an ethical trade. You know, we've just been talking about, you know, cannabis farm weed being involved in violence. We all know about the violence in South America and Mexico linked to the cocaine trade. So obviously, down the line, it's a very unethical trade. But what the government knows fair well from knows very well from its research, is that English people generally don't give a shit about what happens in South America. So it was useless them trying to, they did have a joint PR campaign with the Colombian government about 10 years ago. And I can't remember what it's called now.
Really?
Project something or other. Yeah. But it was basically saying to English cocaine users, just don't snort cocaine, because lots of people are dying in Colombia, and it was all to do with the drug mules, you know, that dog, I can't remember what it's called. But the research showed that just did not touch the size. No one gave a shit. So what they've done is they've used the rise in youth stabbings to say, okay, forget about Colombia or Afghanistan or whatever. This, you're killing the kids in your own neighborhood. And what they did is they tried to link powder cocaine, i.e. middle-class drug users, with these youth killings, and also with county lines as well. And there is no link between these youth killings and county lines with powder cocaine, with the powder cocaine trade. You know, these county lines kids are not selling powder cocaine. They're selling crack and heroin to semi-homeless people. They're not selling... If you read The Telegraph or most of the mainstream press, actually, or listen to a politician or listen to Scotland Yard and Cressida Dick, you would think that County Lines kids were selling powder cocaine to posh people. And you would think that the kind of kids who are being 13-year-olds getting stabbed in the street, flipping, selling cocaine to kind of architects in Stoke Newington. It's just not the case.
And I mean, it's also the case, right, that during austerity, the police service was stripped down, and the NCA, the National Crime Agency, also put drug crime further and further down the list of priorities, right? So there's a kind of direct line between the policing of drug offences and that, right? Is that the case?
Yeah. So ever since 9/11, the policing of the drug trade, certainly in terms of, you know, the NCA and its preceding force, I think, was it SOCA, I think, I can't remember, but there was an absolute shift from the top, ordered from the top, to say, look, we are shifting our resources to two things now. First it was terrorism, then it was people trafficking. And that got precedence over drug trafficking. So you can see, like, you know, rising, so it's falling cocaine seizures over the last 15 years in this country. And that was because they just weren't looking for it anymore. But still, the same amount was coming in, because as the seizures were getting lower, the amount of cocaine use was getting higher. So that can only mean one thing, which is, they're not looking for it, and they weren't. So in terms of, you know, in terms of the borders and stuff, yes, that was they'd almost sort of given up the game in terms of drug trafficking. I think they've slightly turned it around slightly now, because they've got, oh shit, we should try and stop drugs coming in the country. It's our job. and I think you're right. Yeah, austerity has sort of reduced the number of police officers. And some people were blaming rise in youth crime and county lines on reduced policing, but that, I think that's been shown that's not the case. And I think the last time that there was a big bump in youth crime, policing wasn't a problem in 2008-09. It's the same with stop and search. And obviously, it makes complete sense. And I sort of agree with it. You know, if you've got a massive knife crime problem, flipping, you can't just not search people or not look for knives. If you've got people, you have to do it. It's like not an option not to do it. So they you know, the police were searching, did start searching more people from 2017 onwards for knives. You know, and there was a lot of obviously people being stopped on the pretext of drugs, but it was actually being because the police wanted to search them for knives. And so they will see the stop and search figures, the racial disparities went up because You know, a lot of the youth homicides in London, in particular, were by black kids on other black kids. So that's where police were targeting people disproportionately because they were going after knives. But then, you know, research has found since that that wasn't really doing much. It wasn't because the knife crime was just kept on going up and up and up. And also what a lot of young people were telling me during this research that I was doing was that, you know, okay, you might grab a few knives from doing the stop and search, but what that does also do is it continues the terrible relationship between police, between the Met police and young black people in the city, which means that the Met police are no longer really protectors for young black people in their eyes. They are almost the enemy. So they certainly don't go to them for help. And I think if you've got a sort of in their eyes, a sort of a dead police force, a non-existent police force, then it's going to make you more vulnerable to a lot of things, you know, including violence and murder.
That sounds a little bit like London is turning into The Wire from what you're saying in some senses.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, you know, America makes UK, whatever, you know, statistics you look at, makes UK look almost like zero when it comes to street killings, and obviously police killings of young people is very, very small in the UK compared to the situation in the US. But yeah, I mean, I think there was one point a few years ago when the number of people being killed in London was higher than in New York. I remember Trump commenting on it, and obviously so did Katie, what's her, crazy racist
Hopkins woman.
Yes, yeah, she, I mean, yeah, she was saying, you know, kind of like Stab City, Londonistan, and Londonistan, blaming on black people and Asian people, and Trump jumped onto that. But then obviously, you know, since then, New York has, in the last year, due to lockdown, New York has really kicked off again, you know, after violence has absolutely fallen compared to what it was in the 80s and 90s. New York, I think, got a resurge of violence over lockdown, because I just think purely, you know, in that city, it can be hot in that city, and people can get really annoyed with each other. And I think everyone just started killing each other because they were bored.
Yeah, it's always good when you've got a Glock to hand as well, when you are getting a bit pissed off with something.
Yeah, there's not a shortage of them. I mean, and that's the thing, is that, you know, obviously in London, it's all about these youth killings. It's all about knives. I mean, you do get the occasional shooting, but it's all about knives, and obviously knives, even machetes and zombie knives, they're so easy to get hold of. Anyone can get hold of them. There's you know, like outdoor fishing companies that are making a very pretty penny on sending these things in bulk to people who they sort of turn a blind eye to. It's like, oh yeah, 200 knives to a council estate in Hackney. Yeah, fine. I'm sure they're going to go fishing.
Yeah. Can't you get anything in Hackney Marshes these days?
Yeah. So yeah, it's a scandal that this is going on, that these young people are getting killed, and you think, you know, maybe more would be being done about it if they weren't black, if so many of them weren't black or mixed race.
Minorities. Shock horror. You know, this like violent crime affects people of color and people of low income or in low income areas the most, which I guess brings me very tangentially onto my last question for you, which is, what is cuckooing and why is it on the rise?
Yeah, so cuckooing sounds cute, but it's not. So that was sort of takes me back to a point I made before, which is it's one of the sort of modes of operation of the of county lines, but it is not restricted to county lines. It's what it basically is. It's drug dealing crews who take over a vulnerable person's house, sometimes injecting them entirely, to use that house as a drug dealing base. But there's been some sort of quite horrific stories of this sort of method of, you know, keeping away from the police, because obviously when you've got a lot of young traumatized kids who are the drug dealers hanging out in the same quite dingy flat as a heavily traumatized sort of long-term crack and heroin user, it's got to be a recipe for disaster and exploitation, abuse. I mean, it's awful, because there's a lot of mental health issues going on there, a lot of violence, a lot of desperation, a lot of arguments going on. So you can sort of picture the horrific situations that happen, and, you know, the horrible things young people are seeing that they shouldn't be seeing in those flats, the terrible exploitation, and sometimes torture of long-term drug users, some of whom have been murdered by people cuckooing them, some of whom have had find it hard to get help, especially over lockdown when they were sort of isolated even more than usual. So it's kind of, you know, it really is a sort of a weird sort of slightly Dickensian sort of situation where you've got really the most vulnerable people, young and old, in our society sort of cohabiting in these places to kind of, one of them obviously to get paid free drugs for their use of their council flat, which quickly turns into a nightmare. You know, their cat gets stabbed and they moan about it, so they get stabbed as well. You know, it's a horrible situation, and it happened to a friend of mine actually, and it was really horrific to see. And it's just, there's nothing good about it.
No, it doesn't sound like it. So if people are looking around for your work, Max writes for Vice, and I believe that's where your big story that we spoke about earlier is going to be, or will have been just published by the time we're publishing this.
Yeah, that's podcast, going out on Vice World News. So that's where I work at the moment. So I spend most of the time focusing on Europe, Middle East, and Africa sort of area. But sometimes I do write stuff about America. I wrote a big thing the other day about PCP in America and about New York crime statistics. So yeah, I try and sort of cover the world, because my title is Global Drugs Editor, so I might as well go for it.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, when you get traveling, then you'll probably be able to see a lot. I mean,
I can't wait because the furthest I've been in the last 2 years is Norwich.
Oof. I mean, it's grim that you got to Norwich. So,
in terms of work stuff, yeah. So I've got to try and find a really good story, sort of like maybe in the Caribbean or maybe Fiji or something.
Yeah. For our American listeners, Norwich is a very beautiful medieval market town in a gorgeous part of Anglia. And that's all I'm going to say about it.
Yeah, actually, I was stunned by how beautiful it was. Yeah, it's nice.
It's nice up there. Yeah, I was around that way not so long ago. But anyway, Max, thanks ever so much for coming on the show. And yeah, guys, if you want to catch Max on Twitter, his handle is Narcomania, very on brand. And we'll look forward to speaking to you in the future, Max. It sounds like we've got a lot probably that we could chat to you forever about, to be honest.
Yeah, nice one, Sean. Thanks for getting me on.
All right, cheers.
This Is Monsters is a true crime podcast and YouTube channel where I tell the stories of the worst people on the planet. Though the stories of the victims are told, we focus on the monster who carried out the evil act. The show is split into seasons, and each season has a theme. In season one, we covered cases of filicide, which is the act of a parent killing their own child. In season two, we covered cases of people killing for love. We recently finished up season three, where we covered cases of parricide, which is the act of someone killing their parents. Tune in now as we start season four, where we dive into the minds of family annihilators, sick individuals who decided to destroy their entire families. Check us out anywhere that you listen to podcasts or on YouTube by searching This Is Monsters.